Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 14, ERISA and Tax Update. Craig Bittman, Jeannie Cogill, and Richard Zarin will discuss certain important ERISA and tax updates and developments. Now, on to the podcast.
At midnight last Friday, the Department of Labor fiduciary rule went live, that is, became applicable. So yesterday was the fiduciary rule's first full business day, and we're all pleased to see that the sun came up this morning as usual. The earth continues to spin on its axis. All is well in the world. I noticed with amusement that The Economist a couple of weeks ago, when it noted that the fiduciary rule was going live, it actually included it in its sort of world business roundup as a significant world business event. So for us, it certainly is. So what does the fiduciary rule do? Well, it's a very significant amendment to a long-standing regulation under ERISA that defines what investment advice is. Investment advice, of course, to an ERISA plan, an IRA, a KEO plan, or another benefit plan investor. And it's critically important to know who is giving investment advice, because individuals and entities that give investment advice to ERISA plans and IRAs and KEO plans and other benefit plan investors are fiduciaries under ERISA and under the tax code. And fiduciaries are subject to very exacting standards under ERISA and the prohibited transaction rules of the tax code. So including very strict prohibitions on self-dealing. So it's important to know who is providing investment advice. Now, this rule has been around for actually quite a long time. It was first proposed way back in 2010. The final rule was issued last year, and it became effective, of course, last Friday, June the 9th. But its fate, although it is now effective, its fate is somewhat uncertain. The new administration is somewhat hostile to it. In February, the president, by a memorandum to the Secretary of Labor, directed the Department of Labor to examine and determine whether the rule actually adversely affects the ability of Americans to access retirement information and financial advice. The Department of Labor is continuing to review the rule, and we don't actually know what will happen to it ultimately. The SEC has indicated that they might be engaged in some sort of parallel rulemaking. And of course, there are a number of legislative attempts to do away with the fiduciary rule altogether, including the Financial Choice Act, which has just been passed by the House of Representatives, and which would get rid of the fiduciary rule and also, in fact, block the Department of Labor for reintroducing a rule until the SEC actually acts. So the fate's uncertain, but at the moment, it's in play, it is now effective, and we have to deal with it. It's going to have a profound effect, and in fact, it already is having a profound effect on how all types of investment products and services are sold to ERISA plans. In the hedge fund space, which is of course what you guys are all interested in, it's going to affect how you market your funds to plans and how you have ongoing communications with funds. It may be very difficult to market to small plans or to IRAs, or even impossible to do so if the small plans and IRAs are not associated with the hedge fund and its principals.
And it's worth noting here, for many of you know the difference between an ERISA-covered fund and a non-ERISA-covered fund. This applies to both. This is not just something that if you're running a non-plan asset fund, you can just tune out. This is all about the marketing of going into the fund in the first instance, whether or not it's considered to be a plan asset fund.
Right. So if you provide investment advice for a fee to a plan, you become a fiduciary. And that is a big deal because fiduciaries are subject to, in ERISA, very exacting standards of care. And they must also comply with very prescriptive, prohibited transaction rules, including the most important, thou shalt not self-deal. And the impact for hedge fund managers is that your marketing to plans, to IRAs, to ERISA plans, may be considered to be providing investment advice for a fee. And if that is the case, then you become a fiduciary and you become subject to these self-dealing prohibitions. And here's the crux, here's the conundrum. You would be unable to act in your own interest in marketing your wares or setting your own fees even if your hedge fund doesn't hold plan assets, because your financial interest in earning the fee-based compensation from the plan when it invests in your fund is essentially a self-dealing transaction that itself requires an exemption. So in other words, you know, in communicating with your potential plan investors, and in fact, in ongoing communications with your plan investors, you could be considered providing a buy or hold investment recommendation, and then, you know, self-dealing into the bargain. So this obviously puts one into a major conundrum. Can you avoid giving a recommendation in your marketing activities and in your ongoing communications with your plan investors? Well, the Department of Labor has given us a few sort of exceptions, but they are somewhat difficult to comply with. And I think most fund managers have sort of assumed that it's not going to work. One is, you know, providing only investment education, just describing your hedge funds without going further. That's actually a very difficult thing to do. You know, your placement agents and your employees are unlikely to be able to keep on the reservation. Another is just handing them the PPM and not discussing the investment with them at all. Again, something that's very difficult to do. But Craig is going to discuss a very important exception that actually should work, and that is the sophisticated fiduciary exception.
So the DOL recognized that there are certain investors that probably don't need the protection of this new investment advice fiduciary definition, and it basically drew the line at institutional versus retail investors. And so while the rule is applicable to both IRAs and to true ERISA investors, meaning plans, they drew a distinction between the two types of investors. So for ERISA plans, if the plan has at least $50 million in assets or is represented by somebody who has control over $50 million of assets, there's an exception which basically will allow the advice to continue to be provided without it being deemed to be fiduciary in nature. And there are a number of representations that the investor would have to give to the hedge fund manager or to the other advisor in order to rely on that exemption. Thankfully, the DOL has come out and said that those representations can be given through negative consent. And so for the ERISA plans, what we've been seeing and what we are advising our clients is to go out and either through your subscription documents for your new investors or in a negative consent letter for your existing ERISA plan investors, have them represent to you that they are advised by an independent fiduciary, that they have the $50 million of assets under management, that you are adverse to them and the like, so that they can't then claim later that they relied on advice from you as to whether or not to invest in the fund or not invest in the fund. And so that's something that we're working on with a lot of our fund clients now. The tougher case, though, is with respect to the IRA investors, because that seller's exemption doesn't apply. The DOL has come out and made that abundantly clear that the seller's exemption, even if the owner has more than $50 million of assets under management or control over $50 million in the IRA, that seller's exception will not apply. So what do you do with respect to the IRAs? Well, that's, again, it's tougher because you can't just rely on this outright representations like you can for the ERISA plans. And so we kind of see three courses of action with respect to the IRAs. One is to basically just say we're not going to allow any IRAs in the fund, other than maybe friends and family IRAs, which aren't paying fees, because that would not render the advice provider to be a fiduciary under ERISA because there's no fees involved. That might not be practical for you, especially if you have big IRA commitments already. The second course of action would basically be to require each of those IRAs that you have investing to go out and engage an independent fiduciary, basically an advisor, to stand between you and the IRA owner. Again, that might not be all that practical and adds a level of cost to the IRA owner that they might not be too fond of. And the third, and probably the riskiest though, would be to just rely on the fact or try as much as you can not to engage in providing any advice or recommendations with respect to that IRA owners. So that would mean basically just giving a PPM or an offering memorandum or other partnership agreements and the like, but without actually engaging in any discussions with them so that they can't accuse you of having provided them advice and turned you into somehow into a fiduciary under the new rule. Again, not necessarily the most practical solution in the due diligence phase for the IRA investor, but you really want to keep yourself out of those unintended fiduciary discussions. So we've also seen some fund complexes taking the position that they'll send out a negative consent letter, even to the IRA owners, is intended to somewhat mirror the seller's exception negative consent letter that will apply to the ERISA plans. Again, it's not clear that that works. It still is ultimately going to depend upon what advice was provided to that IRA owner. So that's kind of a risky course to go down. The last point I wanted to make on this, and then we can turn this over to Richard for the tax update, is if you are in fact running a plan asset fund, you have to be aware that there are certain exemptions that you might be relying on now that could be impacted by the fiduciary regulation. Specifically, if you're relying on any of the affiliated brokerage or affiliated funds exemptions that allow you to engage affiliated brokers for your fund or use affiliated mutual funds related to your hedge fund, that can be impacted by the fiduciary regulation and impose all kinds of new standards on that of basically fair dealing with your investors and subject them to what is close to an ERISA standard of care. So if you are running a plan asset fund, it's something you absolutely need to pay attention to. And with that, I will turn it over to Rich to give you the tax update.
Sure. Let's see. And we'll just quickly cover a few developments here. Here we go. First, and you'll have seen this obviously in the headlines, the Trump administration had provided a one-page outline of proposed approach to a tax reform package a little while back. There were not a lot of details there. Broadly, what that talked about was reducing the corporate rate of tax down to 15%, making it apply to pass-through operating businesses of various sorts, pausing there, leaving to the question of whether this would invite a wide variety of businesses to reorganize themselves as pass-throughs, you know, whether every individual would like to suddenly be effectively operating their own consulting business. We have a sort of persistent rumored response back from various legislative staff. No, this doesn't mean that lawyers and accountants are suddenly going to be getting the lower break, but no real explanation of where the line would be drawn. Some talk about maybe that goes to just smaller businesses, but smaller measured how. That was one. I think in the hedge fund world, it leads to, combined with persistent talk about carried interest repeal, thoughts about, gee, does this mean that suddenly people would like to have management fees or deferred management fee and performance fee arrangements because they would be able to get a lower tax rate? No details on any of this yet. Lowering the individual rate down to 35%, getting rid of the Medicare contribution tax of 3.8%, and changing the U.S. tax system more broadly so it no longer is a worldwide system for businesses, but more of a territorial sort of the sort as most of the countries of the rest of the world do, with a one-time special deal so that companies like Apple or whatever, all these companies have massive amounts of earnings stored offshore, would be encouraged to bring the money back onshore, say, oh, now we have a lower tax rate and we'll work with that. This set of proposals also comes with some conflicting other proposals. There's a House set of blueprints, what people refer to as the CAMP proposals from a while back. The Senate has their own thoughts. And the one of the key themes there, which congressional staff from very recent meetings and consultations, from everything we hear, is still very interested in, is some sort of border adjustment tax concept, which has some of the flavor of a value-added tax, but with an extra wrinkle intended to basically encourage people to be either doing business wholly in the U.S. or to be acting as exporters, discourage them from being importers. Another piece we're gathering, and all this is just both reading tea leaves and by chatting with people on the Hill and the Treasury, everything is very, very up in the air, is some notion of maybe trying to do everything sort of in a more of an all-at-once way, so that you'd lower business rates down to a lower rate, you'd add this border adjustment tax, value-added tax concept, make it all somehow revenue neutral and do it in a sort of all at once rather than a transitioning way. There had been rumors that the only way you could make this work under Senate rules that would require otherwise 60 senators to approve, which would require Democratic support that there's no indication there would be some sort of a phasing in, phasing out approach, but that doesn't seem to be the flavor of the moment. About the only other comment I'll make on that is that the thought right now is that the Joint Committee of Taxation staff have been told you can't go on vacation until in August you actually deliver a draft of a bill. So we are supposed to see some sort of proposal by August, so we will see where that goes. Also, thinking about our keynote speaker's comments earlier on the carried interest and repeal, it is an interesting question because on the House side, there doesn't seem to be any appetite for it, but it is something you could see getting into a Senate bill and sticking there. The prior proposals had all sorts of mechanical issues, but you know, it's hard to know where that goes either. I guess the other topic I will hit on particularly quickly is from earlier today, and this is printed two pages per side, double-sided. We've got the proposed regulations for the partnership tax audit revised approach that came with the Budget Act from a few years ago. This is something that's supposed to go into effect for tax years starting next year, January 1, 2017, for audits of that year and going forward. There had been proposed regulations released in the very final days of the Obama administration. They had been promptly pulled back as a part of a general sort of regulatory pullback with the new administration, and thus they never quite fit the category of even being proposed. The new regulatory package that came out today takes that 300 pages or so and makes very few changes. Largely, and this will be of interest to people in this room who are fund-of-funds investors and also funds, basically, as they think about how these rules would work, by revising some language saying, gee, we know we're not letting this, you do various push up to higher levels approaches so that a partnership, if it's audited, won't have to pay a tax bill itself, but can push up the responsibility to its partners when there are tiers of partnerships above that partnership. There's, you know, either there are partners that are themselves partnerships or funds of funds and so on. Here, the government has now said in this new release, we are working on further proposed regulations. We're looking for more comments, and they have some phrasing making it sound like that will come out sooner rather than later. So we will have to see. For now, that remains a reserved topic. So even in a proposed form where there's just no guidance. To just step back for a moment, for those of you who have missed this, the theme behind all of this is that the government's ability to audit partnerships would now shift to mean that the partnership itself on an audit would be liable for a tax bill reflecting in a heads I win, tails you lose from the government's point of view way, any manner in which more income items should have gone to a partner or less deduction items. In the first instance, by looking at the highest possible rate, there are then provisions that would allow, with procedures still very up in the air, looking at tax exempts, super tax exempts such as government pension plans, non-US investors, investors or individuals or corporations, and adjusting that bill to reflect the status of your different partners, or to follow different procedures that allow the responsibility for those taxes to be pushed up on partners if they then go and amend their returns or for some other procedures. And all of this reflects that historically the government has had a very hard time auditing partnerships because they've ended up doing it partner by partner and never gotten very far. This gives them much more of a club on audits to, you know, probably over-collect, but frankly, that way collect, you know, they project it as a revenue raiser that way. Guess I would just also note exceedingly briefly, there was a proposal proposed regulations last year and then finalized regulations on related party debt transactions. The original proposed regulations were very expansive. The revised ones were considerably narrower and eliminated a lot of potential worries that particularly people in the private equity fund world had, but somewhat on the hedge fund side. But the theme that comes out of this, which was somewhat there in case law already, is that if you're dealing with related party debt transactions, there will be a real premium on relatively contemporaneous documentation and arm's length terms, you know, that a two-page promissory note with an unreasonable rate that isn't carefully thought about may come back to haunt you. Lastly, I will mention, and this is more directly on the private equity fund side, but it somewhat comes up on the hedge fund side indirectly. The government doesn't appear to be moving forward at this stage, though they never pulled them on the management fee waiver regulations of a few years ago. These were regulations aiming at structures that allowed, through the use of allocations of profits, profit interests, various ways to mimic the economics of somebody getting a management fee and reinvesting it in their fund while allowing a deferral of that income and a potential change of character to capital gains. But even though the regulations aren't visibly moving, there has been a lot of reports of very active audits in the field hitting many of these themes, and sometimes some other related themes in joint ventures and sometimes in hedge funds as well. And I think with that, we're quick overview.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.